Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Grammar Girl here, I'm Mignon Fogarty, and today you'll hear me talk with Neil Whitman about the most interesting language stories that caught our eye in the news. We talked about a new study that showed how people who speak certain kinds of languages have a better memory, how having a word for both light blue and dark blue can help people pick out colors faster, and how language programs around the country are being cut. Plus, at the end, we shared the origin stories of Squiggly, Aardvark, and Fenster, the characters you always hear about in the example sentences. I hope you enjoy it. But first, I have a contest to tell you about. Grammar Girl is part of the Quick and Dirty Tips podcast network. And to celebrate the network reaching the 300 million download milestone, you can enter to win a one-on-one web call with me. It's a long URL, so I'll just put it in the show notes, but it's also the pinned tweet right now at the Quick and Dirty Tips Twitter account, which is just Quick Dirty Tips. And now, on to the show. Hi, Neil. It's great to be here with you today.
Hey, Mignon. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited for the listeners to hear your voice. You've been writing scripts for me for so long. I think it's going to be such a treat for them to actually hear you.
We'll see. I hope so.
Well, as I said in the intro, there are language stories that we see all the time that we don't really get to talk about in the podcast because they don't just fit the script format so well. And so we're going to see what it's like today to just talk about some interesting things that we've seen in language in the last month or so. You might remember that a while ago, Neil wrote a script for the show about whether language influences thought. And this is a controversial topic, and we said that then. And
Maybe so, but I mean, it's the Whorfian hypothesis, as it's sometimes called, or the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. It's been one of these topics that it's been skunked, I think, to use a grammar term, you know, like a word that no matter which way you use it, you're not going to somebody's going to get mad, and so you might as well just stay away from it. And so, and there was so much just badly done claims about, language influencing thought in the early 20th century that, you know, for a long time, it's been this topic that linguists don't like to touch because they're just asking to be, you know, disrespected and not taken seriously. And so, Lera Boroditsky, she decided to go there, and now she sort of owns that space. She's the foremost person on this. She's the one that, you know, she has the reputation of, you know, even if you don't buy the whole Whorfianism thing, you got to give some respect to how she, you know, sets up the experiments and tries to control for various things that that might be going on. And so, yeah, in the script that that I did for you that you ran a little while ago, she was featured prominently. She has that TED Talk. She's been on Hidden Brain. And at first I thought this was just more of the same, but it turns out, no, this is, this is new stuff. So yeah, this is not one that she wrote, but this being a topic of interest to her, she noticed this and read it and tweeted it. And this, it's the word order of languages predicts native speakers' working memory. Looks like it was published just this month, just February, and it's by Federica Amici, Alex Sanchez Amaro, Carla Sebastian Enesco, Trix Cacchioni, Matthias Alritz, Juan Salazar Bernay and Federico Rossano. Federico Rossano. I probably just should have said Amici et al., but there they all are.
We want to give everyone credit, having been a graduate student myself. So it talks about left-branching speakers of left-branching languages, and I think speakers of right-branching languages. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah. So right-branching and left-branching. It has to do with how we draw the diagrams for these sentences. And so as you may know, the linguists, they don't like to use the boxy sort of Reed-Kellogg diagrams that you may have learned in school, but they use these diagrams that look like upside down trees, and hence the word branching. And so
They're more vertical.
They're more vertical, and actually you can think of it like the tree roots instead of the tree branches digging down into the
Oh, that's nice.
But they call them branches, so that's what we're going to have here. So they have in the example here the man who is sitting at the bus stop. So in English, so we have, that's on the left, man, that's to the left of everything else, and then who was sitting at the bus stop, that all comes to the right. But some languages, and the example they give here is Japanese, they would tend to put that entire relative clause before the noun. So if we did something like this in English, it would be like the who was sitting at the bus stop man.
Mm. So the subject, the key agent in the sentence, is the one you have to wait till the end to figure out who that is. Right?
Or in this case, the noun that this relative clause is describing, the who is sitting at the bus stop, man, woman, girl, cat. You just have to wait until the end to get to it. And all this stuff on the all this relative clause all on the left of it, in a picture, you'll see all this stuff on the left, and then the man, it comes at the end on the very right. And then in terms of your memory, you have to keep track of all this in your head before you finally find out it's a man or a woman or somebody else at the bus stop. So
I was saying, it's almost like they're saying that people who speak these languages that sort of push some of the important stuff toward the end, the left-branching languages, that it's almost like the speakers are doing a little memory test or a memory game all the time when they're speaking, because they have to hold these things in memory longer than we do when we're speaking a language like English, which is a right-branching language. Am I understanding that right?
Yeah, that's right. So the man who is sitting at the bus stop, in English we hear, the man, and then we already have that picture, and then we can add who is sitting at the bus stop, and there's less load on our memory. But if we say the who is sitting at the bus stop, man, you got to be patient and listen through that who is sitting at the bus stop and keep thinking, okay, now pretty soon there's going to be a noun here talking about what it is that's sitting at the bus stop.
Well, the next study I want to see is if people who speak these languages are more patient. Not only are they using their memory more, but they're waiting longer to get the information.
Well, I mean, that's one thing that makes these studies different, because before, if you've heard about, do languages influence how you think, it's typically been all about, the words. Do you have two different words for blue? And if you do, well, does that influence how you see the world? But it's about the colors or the genders. This takes it into just outside the language domain, into just memory tasks in general. So as for whether there are more patients in general, that would be an interesting study too. I guess what would you have to do? You'd have to find a operationalize the definition of patient.
And we had both highlighted this one because it seemed so interesting and it was different. I was reading a different one this morning because it did talk about the two different kinds of blue, and they did a study where they flashed 10 things a second in front of people, and then they wanted to know if they noticed them. And just one tiny little thing that jumped out at me is they said, you will always notice your own name. And I thought that was interesting. It was saying how, like, certain words have more, I think it was specificity. I'm not sure that's the right word, but certain words had more something so that you were more likely to notice them. And then they were testing these blues.
Yeah, this I think is the one that, our language affects what we see. And it's in Scientific American by Catherine Caldwell Harris, PhD, also published in January. And at first I saw this and I said, the Russian blue thing. Yeah, I read about that. But then I looked closer and I realized, it's different.
And how was it different?
So they did a couple of things here. What you're talking about here, they say that's called the attentional blink. That's a concept that I just learned when I read this paper, and it has to do with if you catch your name in a rapid series of stimuli, you can catch it. But then if it comes quickly again right after that, if it comes too soon, you don't catch it because your brain's still busy. I don't know, recovering
from the excitement of seeing your name.
yeah, maybe so. But and the idea is just it depending on if you have two words or one word for these colors, the length of time where you're likely to miss something if it comes too soon is different. And I didn't really look so close at that. The part that I found more interesting was a little bit later, and it said, okay, so Russians have these two different words for blue. They have light blue and dark blue, and I had Google Translate pronounce them for me. So,
I did too.
Did you? Okay.
I went to Youglish, which you recommended to me, and it brought up a Lara Berditsky video.
Yeah, the two words are Goloboy and Simi.
Goloboy is light blue, and Simi is
dark blue. Okay. So anyway, then this task, they don't even say those words at all. They just, the task involves people clicking and dragging various, shapes on a background to somewhere else. And so if it's, a red shape on a green background, then it's easy to do. If it's a yellow shape on an orange background, it's a little bit harder to do. And now, what if it's a light blue shape on a dark blue background?
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is, well, if you have different words for these, you're a little bit more proficient in and quicker in doing that than someone who doesn't.
So basically, Russian speakers were better at determining, picking out blue on blue.
Yeah, and Greek, it says, too. But German speakers were about at the level of English speakers because they don't have that, two words for blue there. And so, once again, these are two studies that say, does language influence how you think? And they're doing this with tasks that go to great lengths to not use the words.
But it's fascinating. I mean, these like you wrote about before with the east arm and the west arm instead of left and right, and now the
oh yeah, that was the one. That was the one. You totally have to really change your thinking around to speak this language. You got to change your thinking, as she puts it, just in order to say, "How are you doing?" Because instead of saying "How are you doing," they say, "Hey, where are you headed?"
Wow.
And for that, you got to know your directions.
Bill, because of that, I want to jump ahead a tiny bit, and we had thought that we might want to talk about learning a foreign language. And since we are talking about foreign languages, foreign language programs are being cut from universities at an alarming rate. There was an article in CNN, and just a lot of foreign language programs are being cut at universities. And, you and I were talking about how, learning a foreign language really helped us understand more about English and language in general. So I think you said taking Latin. I took German, but you took Latin, which is harder.
Yeah, I don't know. I've tried doing, I took Latin in class. I never took German in classes. I did Duolingo German.
Mm.
So very different approaches. So. But yeah, I took Latin in high school. We were living in El Paso, and El Paso, Texas, and I took Spanish in 7th and 8th grade and learned a little bit about it there. But, we learned the present tense, and then we got into the preterite tense. But beyond that, I really wasn't too interested in learning much more about it. I like the class, but, imperfect tense, that's just something in the appendix of the book, and we don't have to learn about that. So I just kind of ignored it. But I remember walking home with my, stack of textbooks in my hand, in my arms, and just looking through the Latin textbook on the way home. And in the very first page, it talks about declensions. I said, what on earth are you talking about? And so that's what prompted me to look at the back of our dictionary, which had a sort of a grammar appendix in the back. And that's when I learned about the different tenses, present, past, the present perfect, future perfect, and other things like that. Maybe that was the right time in my life. I just found it really interesting. And then when I showed up at school a week later and we started learning it in Latin, I just found every bit of it really interesting, and then looked back at English and drew comparisons and things. And if I'd lived a few hundred years ago, I totally would have been one of those people that complained about how English grammar was all sloppy and bad because it wasn't like Latin, you know.
Yeah, and I took German, and I distinctly remember that was where I really, where parts of speech really clicked in my mind. The nouns and the verbs and the adverbs and the adjectives and just the real basics is really, I didn't really learn that until I started taking a foreign language. And I hear that from a lot of listeners, that they really didn't get a good understanding of English grammar, like grammar per se, until they took a foreign language. And this article in CNN says that 651 foreign language offerings have been terminated in 3 years, between 2013 and 2016. And French took the biggest hit. French was apparently being canceled all over the place. But then also wow. Spanish and Italian. And Spanish really surprised me because, you know, at least where I live on the West Coast, you know, that's the most useful language that I could learn. I'm actually trying to learn Spanish.
I did not realize that. I'm on our local school board here, and one of the things that that I wanted to see happen was increased foreign language offerings in our school, and I'm happy to see that they are on the increase. By the way, in educational circles these days, it's preferred to call them world languages because. You know, hey, foreign language, that's, well, how U.S.-centric, you know, because Spanish is not a foreign language to people who live in Mexico and Spain and,
that's true.
And South America. Yeah. So, foreign language, world language. But Chinese is quite popular, and it's taught online mostly or remotely. And then and every year there's some students that will actually make a field trip to China.
That'd be so fun. So now we're going to talk about something that Neil told me is called One Form, One Meaning. And I noticed, I have an article about the two different spellings of gray, the spelling with an A that predominates in America and the spelling with E that predominates in England. But when I post that, I always get comments on the Facebook post or the tweet. People think that those two different spellings are two different shades of gray, and they're not, as far as the formal definitions go, and it always blows my mind, and it happens every time. And I mentioned it to Neil, and then you've noticed the same thing.
Well, yeah, it's actually something that's well known and amongst linguists, and the term one form, one meaning is a nickname given to it by the linguist Arnold Zwicky. At least I think he originated it. He's an emeritus professor from Ohio State and Stanford, and he has a linguistics blog, but he likes giving nicknames to various linguistic phenomena. So this one's one form, one meaning, or OFOM, as he writes it. But it was originally, I think, it's said best by a linguist named Dwight Bollinger, and it's one of these quotes or paraphrases I see several times, but I've never actually seen the original source that it came from. But the idea is, there's no such thing as a true synonym or no such thing as a perfect synonym. So even with something that you just think is when you're giving examples of synonyms, you'll probably say something like, couch and sofa, those are synonyms. But when you look closer, you realize, that thing we rescued from a fraternity house front yard one time, and now we have it on the front porch, that would be a couch. We wouldn't call that a sofa, but when I go home and visit my mom in the living room, that's a sofa,
Right. And it's so interesting because they aren't part of the formal definitions. Here's an example of a comment on gray versus gray. This is Coffee Quills from Twitter said, "I always saw gray with an A as a harsh color, the steel of daggers, for example. Gray with an E is softer, smoother, moonbeams raining into the room as I go to sleep." In his or her mind, these are two completely different colors.
Yeah, it's like I never got that, but that's not because I'm immune to this this kind of thinking, because I realized that I fell right into it myself, as a child. Hard candy on a stick, all right? So what do you call that?
Yeah, I think I'd call it a sucker.
Okay, and so do I, but I also call it lollipop, I learned both these words as a child, and what must have happened, I think, is the first time I, you know, had the word lollipop, somebody, you know, I had a spherical lump of hard candy on a stick. Mm-hmm. And the first time I had a sucker, I had a disc-shaped hard candy on a stick. So I said, aha,
a flat circle. Yeah.
If it's flat, it's a sucker. If it's like a ball, it's a lollipop. Yeah. Okay. All right. And then I just went along with that distinction in my head, and nobody was ever the wiser, because that's how a lot of language change happens. People have different meanings or different, you know, analyses of things in their head, and they never come to light until, you know, one day there's a misunderstanding. And so, and I think it was in high school when the drill team was selling, you know, blow pops as a fundraiser. And I'd hear person after person telling him, hey, yeah, give me a sucker. Yeah, I want to buy a sucker. And I would silently think, why do they keep calling them suckers? You know, what, they're lollipops. Stop calling them suckers. And finally, you know, it bugged me enough that I said to a friend of mine, like, why do they keep calling him suckers? Did they just not like the word lollipop or something? And that's when I found out that my understanding of the meaning of lollipop and sucker was not shared by, you know, by my friend and possibly by anybody else. So
yeah, most people would think they were the same thing, just a different name for the same thing. I bet the lollipop one is more common because of the Tootsie Pop commercials.
Well, I mean, you'd think that, but I mean, here is a whole, there's Tootsie Pops and these Charms Blow Pops, and they actually have the word pop right in the name, and people were still calling them suckers. And I guess it's just, you know, what you happen to, it's like imprinting, you know?
And like you were saying, it's almost like our brains want to assign different meanings. If there are two different words, we want there to be two different meanings. We don't like the idea that there are two words for the identical thing.
It's like, what, you know, why would we do this? Why would we have, you know, why create extra work for ourselves? There's got to be some reason for having this. So,
and you and I both noticed another one for whoa. So there's WHOA, which is the proper spelling of the word whoa, but then more and more people are starting to, I call it a misspelling, is WOAH. And so I have another article that's, you know, whoa versus whoa, and the one with H-O in the middle is right. But I always get comments. People think that they mean different things. And you had noticed the same thing on a different blog.
I mean, I hadn't noticed it, but a friend of my brother Glenn, he posted something on his Facebook page, and he said, "Help an old dude out here. When did whoa become whoa? It's a chance to watch an accepted spelling change right before our eyes."
Yeah, and Kitty Murdy said what I hear a lot. She said, I thought whoa, W-H-O-A, was the one you use to rein in your horse, and whoa, W-O-A-H, is an exclamation. And I hear people saying, like, it's like when Keanu Reeves says, whoa.
Yeah.
Like, they think it's spelled the other way.
Yeah, and the same communication is, one guy, another commenter says, one is for communicating with horses, the other with people. Now, he doesn't say which one is which, but I thought there was one commenter in here that had the same distinction, but it went in the opposite direction. Like,
yeah, I've seen that too.
Yeah, so
same with gray. People don't think they're the same different colors. They think they can be all over the board, but they're just always they're different. But and with woe and woe, it, again, like it's not consistently what they mean, but that they always. Not always, because most people, it's a minority of people who think they have different meanings. But when people do think they have different meanings, they aren't always the same different meanings. So it's
fascinating. They create their own distinctions, and they don't always match with each other. Actually, Glenn had some interesting speculation on why this might have happened. He said it's a couple of things. You know, one, the W and H merger. So, you know, for most English speakers these days, WH is pronounced just exactly the same as W. Now, I think our family has preserved the distinction because it's in our name.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but when I say, you know, my name's, you know, Whitman, it'll get spelled W-I-T-T-M-A-N. Or, and then they'll say, oh, you know, is it W-I-T-T-M-A-N? And I'll say, no, Whitman. And they'll say, oh, Quitman, mm-hmm. Quitman. They just when they hear the H in there, they think it's the H that you get when you have a K or a P or a T sound at the beginning of a word. So and so as a result, WH is just like many other combinations with a consonant plus H that just seems to be kind of randomly in there because unless you happen to know the spelling rules of the language where it came from. And if you don't quite remember where the H goes, you just put it in there somewhere. And that's why, for example, you get Gandhi spelled with an H after the G, an H after the D, or sometimes both.
Mm-hmm.
Or Kazakhstan, you'll get, an H after one K or the other K or both Ks.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, yeah, just put it in there somewhere.
Yeah. So I think we're about ready to wrap up, and I would love to end by talking about Squiggly, Aardvark, and Fenster, because I created Squiggly and Aardvark, and people often wonder where they came from. But you have invented Fenster, who is a character we use in our example sentences a lot. So do you want to share the origin of our wonderful Fenster?
What about the origin of Squiggly and Aardvark? I mean, when I heard the name Aardvark, I figured, oh, it's an aardvark. And for Squiggly, the first thing I thought was like Lenny and Squiggy from Laverne and Shirley. And then it's Squiggly. And I pictured it, maybe it's a squid or something, and then eventually mentioned that, that Squiggly was a snail. Or maybe I picked up one of your books and realized that. So where did you get aardvark and Squiggly?
Yeah, so Squiggly is a yellow snail because I spent a lot of years at UC Santa Cruz. My husband went to grad school there, and we lived in Santa Cruz for many years. And the mascot is a snail, a slug. Actually,
the banana slug, yes.
But it looks like a yellow snail, and he's adorable. And there are cartoons all over town of the banana slug. And so in my mind, his name isn't Squiggly. I forget what it is, but I always thought of him as Squiggly. And it just popped into my head when I was thinking of characters for the podcast. So Squiggly is a yellow snail based on the UC Santa Cruz banana slug, which is a fabulous mascot.
That's
for
true.
A school. And just so unusual and so fitting. And there are banana slugs all around Santa Cruz, and they are bright yellow. And then aardvark is a blue aardvark. And I don't know, I just thought aardvark was a really funny name. And years later, I had a comedy writer do a piece for me about what makes words funny. And he actually said words with Ks and Qs are inherently funny. So Squiggly with the Q and aardvark with the K are apparently inherently funny names. And probably my favorite story is, I know that I have listeners all over the world and that some people use the podcast to learn English. And someone from China once asked me if a Squiggly was a common American name. And I wanted so much to say yes, but I didn't. I told the truth and I said, no, it's just a funny name I made up.
Yeah, well, yeah. And it's interesting, I was just thinking now, it's related to like squiggle, kind of like a snail shell, looks like a little squiggle you might draw, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But in squiggle, the ul is a syllable all by itself. But when you add e to it, you don't end up with three syllables, squiggly. It's squiggly. And all of a sudden, the l magically transforms back into
a
consonant.
That's
kind of cool. Yeah, kind of like,
Yeah, and also in my mind, they're buddies. They're like Bert and Ernie or Felix and I forget his name now, the Odd Couple.
Oh, Oscar.
Oscar and Felix.
Oscar, yeah.
They're sort of antagonistic buddies who, play off each other. So, and Squiggly loves chocolate and he's kind of lazy and Aardvark's grumpy and he likes to fish.
So, yeah, so I would hear these in examples. And then I think there was also like a Sir Fragalot.
Oh, right. Yeah, Sir Fragalot.
One or two.
Who shouts out sentence fragments. Yes, his job is to shout out sentence fragments.
we haven't heard from him in quite some time.
That's true.
I haven't been inspired to include him in the episodes I read. But yeah, so I think probably I needed another character in there because maybe it was because I was talking about, indirect objects. And so, for a sentence with an indirect object, well, you need a subject, you need a direct object, at least, and then, and then an indirect object. So you got three participants, and so you had Squiggly and Aardvark. And so I just said, all right, I need to put in somebody else. So Fenster is a cat. And this comes from when my wife Amanda and I were just in our first couple of years of marriage living in an area in just north of downtown Columbus, Ohio, called Victorian Village, there was a corner drugstore, which now I know that they're called bodegas, mm-hmm. or at least in New York, that's what they call them. Mm-hmm. That was a word I didn't have in my vocabulary at the time. But we would sometimes go walking around the neighborhoods, and like in New York, some of these cats like to sit in the windows. And so there were two cats that would sit in the window of this bodega. And one of them was black and white, and Amanda loves cats. We have several, you know. So she went in and asked the proprietor what that cat's name was, and he said, "Oh, you know, his name is Bloomers because it looks like he's wearing bloomers. Mm-hmm. He's sort of old fashioned." And then the other one, I think, was kind of an orange one, and that one he said was named Fenster. And I just thought that was kind of a funny name. When I started learning German on Duolingo, I learned that, you know, Fenster, das Fenster is a window. Right. So I wonder if that's why they name him Fenster.
Yeah.
And so when I needed a name, I just put in Fenster. And so I don't know who you picture when you picture Fenster, but when I do, I picture just, you know, a cat interacting with the snail in the aardvark.
Yeah, join the buddy group. It made me think, because I did take German, so I knew Fenster was window, and I was trying to think of English words that have the same root, and the only one I could think of was defenestration, which means to throw someone out the window, the act of throwing someone out the window, and you see it on a lot of, like, favorite word lists and stuff like that, but I had never looked it up before, and it comes from Latin. The Latin word for window is also Fenestra, so similar to the German. I assume they're related. I don't know for sure. But it had a great story. So this is from Etym Online. Defenestration is a word invented for one incident, the defenestration of Prague in 1618, when two Catholic deputies to the Bohemian National Assembly and a secretary were tossed out the window of a castle, and goes on and on. And this marked the start of the 30 Years' War. And apparently they landed on a trash heap and survived. So this is all from Etym Online, but like it was a word invented for one specific event that started the 30 Years' War. I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was the event. What I'd heard about, you know, defenestration is, aside from what it means, is people saying, oh, well, you know, that's a word that people don't actually use. They just like to trot it out and say, you know, here's what it means. Mm-hmm. But I have actually heard it used more recently. In fact, I just looked it up right now. Bill Browder, a guy who's the driving force behind what's known as the Magnitsky Act.
Oh, I knew his name.
Russian sanctions on Russian oligarchs, so they can't get their money. And Bill Browder, Sergei Magnitsky, was his lawyer in Russia, trying to help him, you know, sort out, you know, some fraud and tax stuff that was going on with him. And Sergei Magnitsky was thrown out of the window of his building, and that's how he was murdered.
Oh no!
And in fact, this Magnitsky Act. If you want to, you know, for those of you listeners who want to go, you know, political, feel free to go, you know, Google that and find out more than you ever wanted to know about Russia and sanctions and whatever else. But I'm looking at an article here from the Daily Beast from 2 years ago, and here it is in a sentence. It says, "Let's see, according Bill Browder, a noted Putin critic." Says that Nikolai Gorokhov is in the intensive care unit of Botkin Hospital in Moscow with severe head injuries after allegedly being defenestrated from his building.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, so I thought it was Magnitsky that was killed that way, but this guy, maybe it's a similar MO. This guy, at least 2 years ago, was in the intensive care unit of the hospital. But it's actually a past tense of the verb, defenestrated.
Well, let's hope there aren't many more opportunities for that to be used in real articles. And not, it's better when people just trot it out because it's fun to say or they want to use it than if there are real reasons to use it.
Yeah. But I'm sorry. Yeah. Aside from the turn from the serious, I have heard one other word with, you know, that Latin root in there. And that's just the pure and simple Latin borrowing fenestra, which... I remember from my anatomy class in college, it's a name applied to a few holes in your skull, I think, where various cranial nerves go in or out, or I don't know, maybe some medical students can reach out to you and tell you, you know, what holes in the human body are called, you know, fenestra.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me today. This has been great.
Yes, it's been great fun. Thank you.
Yeah, I hope the listeners enjoy getting to know you a little better. And you have at least two pieces coming up, scripts that you've delivered that'll show up in the podcast in the coming weeks. One about what we're calling it witness. It's about some complicated sort of grammar stuff that's really fascinating. And then you sent me your article about the schwa, and I love it. It's going to be great. I love the. Well, I won't give it away, but I think listeners have a treat coming with that one. So, Well, everyone, I'm Mignon Fogarty, better known as Grammar Girl, and today I was here with Neil Whitman. You're not better known as anything. You are Neil Whitman, but
I'm Neil Whitman, known on Facebook and Twitter, or actually just on Twitter as Literal Minded. That's also the name of my linguistics blog. And then when I'm not doing that, I'm teaching English as a second language to graduate students here at Ohio State.
Fabulous. Well, you can find me at quickanddirtytips.com, and that's all. Thanks for listening.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.